The Curiosity, written by Dan Abnett, read by Toby Longworth. He was, it is fair to say, already weary of Gershom when The Curiosity came to light. 7 years is a long time in any man's career. 7 years living and working in grubby tenements, backwater hostels and frontier habs all over the planet. Long enough to feel like a native, and certainly to look like one, although he had been born 42 years and many million AU distant. The patched worsted suit with shiny calloused elbows, the slate-grey weather coat, fingerless leather gloves, wire-framed spectacles, the skin of his face etiolated from too many short, wintry days, his thin hair unnaturally black from a bi-weekly chemical treatment that he purchased and applied himself. This insipid and forlorn figure stared at his reflection in the smoked glass screen of the demograph booth.
"Present papers. State name and occupation," the indistinct form behind the screen said.
As he spoke, the words appeared in glowing block capital hollows on the glass. He put his crumpled documents into the metal drawer below the screen, and it gobbled them away with an unoiled clatter. Hunching low, he aimed his mouth helpfully at the vox grill and said, "Valentin Drusha, Magos Biologis."
"Purpose of travel," the voice said, subtitled as before.
"I am a Magos Biologis, as I said. You'll see, I have a permit for travel to Outer Udar, stamped by the office of the Lord Governor. He is my patron." The shape behind the tinted glass panel paused, and then the legend, "Please wait," appeared on the screen. Doing as he was told, Drusha stood back, rubbing his hands together briskly to chafe warmth into them. It was a miserably early morning in the last few days of autumn, and the terminal was vacant. Outside it was not yet light. The sky was a patchy blue, the colour of a Tarconi Tarconil's winter plumage, and the orange glare of sodium lamps reflected in the puddles on the rain-slicked concourse. Drusha studied the reflections, and they reminded him of the fluorescent banding on the abdomen of the southern latitude glow moth, Luminous Gershomi. The air held the bitter foretaste of another hard Gershom winter closing in. He consoled himself with the thought that he would be long gone before winter came. Just a few more days to tidy up this annoying loose end, and then he would be done at last. The drawer slot clacked open again, his refolded papers laid inside.
"Proceed," said the voice.
Drusha retrieved his papers, gathered up his bags and equipment cases, and walked into the boarding yard to find himself a seat on the interprovince coach. It wasn't hard. The vehicle, a converted military greff carrier from the peninsula, was all but empty. An old woman in a purple shawl sat alone, fingering rosary beads as she read from a dog-eared devotional chapbook. A young mother, hard-faced and tired, occupied another bench seat, her two small children gathered up in her skirts. A rough-faced agri-worker in leather overalls nodded, half asleep, one arm protectively around the baskets of live, clucking poultry he shared his seat with. His hound, lean and grinning, prowled the aisle. Two young men, identical twins, sat side by side, motionlessly intent. Drusha set himself down near the front of the cabin, far away from anyone else. He shooed the dog away when it came sniffing at his bags. A hooter sounded, waking the agri-worker briefly. The coach's big, caged props began to turn and beat, and the patched rubber skirts of the bulky ground-effect vehicle began to swell out. Drusha felt them drunkenly rise up. One of the little children laughed out in glee at the bobbing motion as the vehicle picked up speed. Then they were out of the city terminal and roaring up to the state highway, fuming spray into the gloomy dawn. Outer Udar, the most western and, many said, the most heathen of Gershom's provinces, lay far beyond the Tartrid Mountains, 40 hours away. For the first hour or two he worked on his notes, refining technical descriptions on his data slate. Such polish was simply cosmetic. He'd been over it 100 times, and the taxonomy would have been published as complete by now. Complete, but for the curiosity. He put his slate aside and took the crumpled voxgram from his pocket, hoping yet again that it was a mistake. 7 years, 7 damn years of rigorous work. To miss a subform of tick fly, a variant weevil, even a divergent rodenti, well, that would be just the way of things. Even, he considered, some class of grazer, if it was localized and sufficiently shy in its habits. But an apex predator? Surely, surely not. Any systematic taxonomy identified all apex predators in the initial phase of preparation by dint of the fact they were the most obvious of any world's creatures. No, it was a mistake. The curiosity in Outer Udar was an error. He'd stake his reputation on that. The rolling motion of the Greff coach began to lull him. He fell asleep, dreaming of the characterizing mouthparts of filter snakes, the distinguishing feather palps of lowland locusti, and the bold, striated beaks of peninsular huskpeckers. He woke to the sound of infant laughter. The coach was stationary, and sleet was dashing against the grey windows. Blinking, he sat up and repositioned his dislodged spectacles on his nose. At his feet, the two children had his sketchbooks laid open and were giggling as they surveyed the hand-painted images of beasts and fowls. "Please," he said, "please be careful with those." The children looked up at him.
"Zoo books," said one.
"Yes," he replied, taking the sketchbooks away from their grubby hands and closing them.
"Why have you got zoo books?"
"I make zoo books," he said. They thought about this. Their simple grasp of professional careers did not reach so far. One nudged the other.
"Are you going to put the beast in your zoo books?"
the nudged one asked.
"The beast?" he asked.
"Which beast?"
"The hill beast. It has teeth. Great large teeth. It eats men up, and swine, with its great large teeth. It has no eyes."
"Come away," their mother called, and the two children scurried back down the aisle to her. Drusha looked around the cabin. It was just as he had last seen it. The agri-worker continued to snooze. The old woman was still reading. The only change was the twins, who now sat facing one another, like a mirror. The cabin door thumped open, and flakes of sleet billowed in around several newcomers. A black-robed demograph servitor, its face a cluster of slack tubes beneath augmetic compound eyes. A short-haired woman in a leather body glove and fur coat, carrying a brown paper parcel. Another agri-worker, his face chilblained, fighting to keep his long-haired terrier from snapping at the roaming hound. A matronly progenium schoolteacher in a long grey dress. The short-haired woman helped the matron with her luggage.
"Leofric, this is Leofric," the servitor called as he walked the cabin. "Present your papers."
Each voyager offered up his or her documents for the servitor to scan. Gershon was very particular about its indigence, the side effect of being so close to a war zone. The Departamento Demographicae maintained a vigilant watch on the planet's human traffic. The servitor, waste spittle drooling from its mouth tubes, took a long time studying Drusha's papers.
"Magos biologis."
"Yes."
"Reason for travel."
"I went through all this at the terminal this morning."
"Reason for travel."
Drusha sighed. 7 years ago, I was commissioned by the Lord Governor of Gershom to draw up a comprehensive taxonomy of the planet's fauna. It is all but complete. However, a curiosity has appeared in Outer Udar, and I am travelling there to examine it."
Drusha wanted to go on, to talk about the extended deadlines he had been forced to request, the increasingly reluctant project funding that had obliged him to take the overland coach instead of a chartered flyer, the preposterous idea that he might have missed an apex predator. The demograph servitor wasn't interested. It handed the papers back to Drusha and stalked away. In the meantime, the short-haired woman had taken the seat opposite him. She smiled at Drusha. Her face was lean and sturdy, with a tiny scar zagging up from the left-hand corner of her lip. Her eyes were dazzling amber, like photoluminescent cells. Drusha looked away.
"Magus biologus," she said.
"Yes.
I couldn't help overhearing, apparently."
The servitor had dismounted. With a lurch like sea swell, the Greff carrier rose and got underway again.
"I was told you were coming," she said.
"What?" The woman reached into her fur coat, Highland Fox, if he wasn't mistaken, and produced a wallet, which she flipped open to reveal the golden badge inside.
"Jermaine Max, Province Arbites."
"You were expecting me, officer?" "A squirt from the governor's office. An expert on his way. I'm thrilled, of course. It's about time. So, what's the plan?"
"Plan? Your M.O.?"
Drusha shrugged.
"I suppose I'll examine habitat, look for spores, collate cases, and get a decent pict or two if I can."
His voice trailed off. In 7 years, no official had ever taken such interest in his work.
"And how do you plan to kill it?" she asked.
"Kill it?" he echoed.
"Yes,"
she said, chuckling.
as if party to some joke, that being the point. I don't intend to kill it. I don't take samples, just descriptive records for the taxonomy. He patted his sketchbooks. But you have to kill it, she said earnestly. I mean, if you don't, who the hell will?
By the firelight of the great hearth, Baron Khan went on expansively for several minutes. The Lord Governor is a personal friend, a childhood friend, and when he makes it known that a scholar such as yourself is coming to my part of the world, I take pains to make that scholar welcome. Ask, and it will be given, Magos. Any service, any requirement, I am happy to provide.
Thank you, Baron, Drusha said uneasily. He looked around the room. Trophy heads, crested with vast antlers and grimacing their fangs, haunted the shadowy walls.
A winter storm battered at the leaded windows. Outer Udar was colder than he had dared imagine.
I wonder if there might have been a mistake, Drusha ventured.
How is that?
Sir, I am a taxonomist, a scholar. My expertise is in the cataloguing of fauna forms. The Lord Governor, your childhood friend, as you say, commissioned me to compile a concordance of Gershom's animal life. I've come here because, well, there seems to be a curiosity out here I may have missed. A predator. I'm here to identify it for the taxonomy, not to kill it. I'm no hunter.
You're not?
Not at all, sir. I sketch and examine and catalogue.
The Baron bowed his head.
Dear me. Really?
I'm truly sorry, sir.
He looked over at the door into the dining room. It was ajar, and light slanted through the gap.
What will I tell them?
The Baron said. Drusha felt desperately out of his depth.
If you have guests, I mean, to save face, I could play along, I suppose.
Around the long candlelit table were 19 local lairds and their ladies, the returned Bishop of Udar and his secretary, and a square-jawed man with sandy white hair and piercing eyes. His name was Sko. Drusha wasn't entirely sure who Sko was. In fact, he wasn't entirely sure of anything any more. The Baron introduced him as "that expert from the city I've been promising."
"You're a famous hunter, then?" the Bishop asked Drusha.
"Not famous, Your Holiness. I have some expertise in the line of animals."
"Good, good. So claims Sko here. But in 3 months, what?" "It is a difficult beast, Your Honour," Sko said softly. "I'd welcome some expert advice. What weapon do you favour, Magos? Hollow point or shot? Do you bait? Do you use blinds?"
Favour multiple means, sir. Whatever suits."
"Aren't you terribly afraid?"
asked one of the ladies.
"One must never underestimate the quarry, lady," Drusha said, hoping it conveyed an appropriate sense of duty and caution.
"They say it has no eyes. How does it find its prey?" asked the Bishop.
"By scent," Drusha replied emphatically.
"Not so," snapped Sko. "My hunters have been using sealed body sleeves. Not one sniff or pheromone escapes those suits, and still it finds them."
"It is," said Drusha, "a difficult beast. When was it last seen?"
"The 13th, said the Baron. "Up in the Ridgeway, having taken a parlour-maid from the yard at Laird Connacht's manse. My men scoured the woods for it, to no avail. Before that, the swineherd killed at Carla, the waterman at Sont's Crossroads, the 2 boys out late by Lair's Mere."
"You forget," said one of the lairds. "My potman, just before the killings at the Mere."
The Baron nodded. "My apologies."
"The beast is a blight on our land," said the Bishop. "I say to you all, a speck of chaos. We must rally round the holy Aquila and renounce the darkness. This thing has come to test our faith."
Assenting murmurs grumbled around the table.
"Are you a religious man, Magos?" the Bishop asked.
"Most certainly, Your Holiness."
"You must come to worship at my temple tomorrow. I would like to bless you before you begin your bloody work."
"Thank you, Your Holiness," Drusha said.
The outer door burst open, scudding all the candle flames, and a servant hurried in to whisper in the Baron's ear. Baron Khan nodded, and the servant hurried out again. A moment later, RBT's officer Max was standing in the doorway, dripping wet, a riot gun over one arm. Her badge was now pinned to the lapel of her leather bodysuit. She looked around the room, pausing as she met Drusha's eyes.
"Deputy," said the Baron, rising from his seat, "to what do we owe this interruption?"
"Another death, Lord," she said. "Out by the coops."
The acreage to the north of Baron Khan's drafty keep was a low swathe of marshy ground given over to poultry farming. Through the sleeting rain, thanks to the light of the bobbing lamps, Drusha could make out row upon row of coop sheds constructed from maritime ply and wire. There was a strong smell of mud and bird lime. Drusha followed the Baron and Officer Max down boarded paths fringed by gorse hedges. With them came three of the Baron's huskarls, lanterns swinging from the tines of their billhooks. The weather was dreadful. Icy rain stung Drusha's cheeks numb, and, as he pulled his old weathercoat tighter around him, he longed for a hat and a warm fox fur jacket like the one Max wore. There was not wobbling noise, just audible over the drumming of the rain. Drusha realized it was the agitated clucking of thousands of poultry birds. They reached the coops and trudged up a metal mesh walkway between the first two shed rows. The bird dung stink was stronger now, musty and stale despite the rain. Teased clumps of white feathers clogged the cage wire. Max said something to the Baron and pointed. A flashlight beam moved around up ahead. It was one of Max's junior RBTs, a young man by the name of Lussin, according to his quilted jacket's name tag. He looked agitated and extremely glad to see company at last. The frame door to one of the coop sheds was open. Max shone her light inside. Drusha caught a glimpse of feathers and some kind of metal cylinder lying on the floor. He followed Max and the Baron into the coop. Drusha had never seen a dead body before, except for that of his uncle Rudiger, who had died when Drusha was a boy. The family had visited his body in the Chapel of Rest to pay their respects, and Uncle Rudiger had looked normal, asleep. Drusha, with a child's naivety, had quite expected his uncle to jump up and laugh in their faces. Uncle Rudiger had been a great one for practical jokes. The body in the poultry coop wasn't about to jump up or do anything. It was face down, thankfully, its limbs draped in a contorted, awkward way that wasn't a practical joke. This was one of the Baron's farm staff, apparently, a yeoman called Calkin. He'd been doing the night feed, and the metal cylinder Drusha had seen was Calkin's grain hopper, lying where he'd dropped it in a pile of spilt maize. Max knelt by the body. She looked up at Drusha and made a little jerk with her head that indicated he might want to go outside again. Drusha stuck his hands in his coat pockets resolutely and stayed put. With a shrug, Max turned the body over.
"Are you all right?"
Max said.
"What? Are you all right?"
Drusha opened his eyes. He couldn't remember leaving the coop, but he was outside in the rain again, leaning against the barn opposite, his hands clenched in the wire mesh so tight he'd drawn blood.
"Megas?"
"Yes,"
he stammered.
"I'm fine."
He thought it likely that he'd never forget what he'd just seen. The awful flop of the rolling body. The way a good deal of it had remained behind on the muddy floor.
"Take a few deep breaths," she said.
"I really am fine."
"You look pale."
"I'm always pale."
She shrugged.
"You might as well stay here," she added,
though Drusha felt she'd said it less out of concern for his nerves and more because she knew he wasn't particularly useful.
"I'm going to make some notes in situ."
"There were bites," he said.
"Yes," Max replied. "At least I think so."
"Measure them, and examine the bite radius for foreign matter, tooth fragments that might have lodged in the bone, that sort of thing."
"Right," she said, and turned away.
"Where did it get in?" he called after her.
"What?"
"Where did it get in? Was the cage door open?"
"No. He'd fastened it behind him when we found him."
"Can I borrow a flashlight?"
Max got a lamp pack from Lussin and gave it to Drusha. Then she went back into the coop with the Baron to begin her grisly inspection properly. Drusha began to walk away down the length of the coop run, shining his torch in through the cages on either side.
"Don't roam too far, sir," one of the huskarls called after him.
Drusha didn't answer. He wanted to roam as far as he could. The thought of being anywhere near that bloody, dismembered mess made him shiver. He was sweating despite the winter gale.
10 meters down, near the end of the row, he found the wire cage roof of one of the coops had been torn wide open. Drusha played the torch around. He was near the end fence of the poultry compound, a 3-meter timber pail topped with a barbed and electrified string of wires. He could see no hole in the fence or damage to the deterrent wires. Had the beast cleared the wall itself? Quite a leap. There was no sign of spore in the thick mud at his feet. The rain was washing it into soup. He let himself into the ruptured stoop and examined the torn wire roof. With the rain splashing off his face, he reached up and yanked part of it down, studying the broken ends with his lamp closely. It wasn't torn, it was cut, cleanly. The tough wire strands simply severed. What could do that? Certainly not teeth, not even teeth that could take the front off a man's face and body. A power blade, perhaps. But that would leave signs of oxidation and heat fatigue. As far as he knew, and there was no man on Gershom better qualified, there wasn't an animal on the planet that could leap a 3-meter security fence and slice open reinforced agricultural mesh. Drusha took out the compact digital picture he always carried and took a few snaps of the wire for reference. It came through this cage roof, he thought. Probably landed on it, in point of fact, coming over the fence, cut its way in, and then what? He looked around. The covered timber coop end of the shed was dark and unforthcoming. It suddenly occurred to him that whatever it was might still be there. He felt terror and stupidity in roughly equal measures. He'd been so anxious to get away from that terrible corpse and prove he was good for something, the blindingly obvious had passed him by. It was still here. It was still right here in the shadows of the coop box. Once the idea had entered his brain, it became unshakable fact. It really was there, just out of sight in the gloom, breathing low, gazing at him without eyes, coiling to pounce. He backed towards the cage door, fumbling for the latch. He could hear it moving now, the rustle of straw, the crunch of dried lime on the box's wooden floor. Dear God, Emperor, he was going to... Drusha, Golden Throne, I nearly blasted you! Max emerged from the coop box, straw sticking to her wet hair. She lowered her riot gun.
What are you doing here? She asked.
I was looking for traces, he said,
trying to slow his thrashing pulse. He gestured up at the torn cage roof.
You'll love this, then, she said,
and led him into the stinking darkness of the coop box. The floor was littered with dead poultry, feathers glued to the wallboards with blood. The smell of offal was overpowering and made him gag. Max shone her flashlight at the end wall and showed him the splintered hole in the timbers. It came in and went right down through the rows of coops, smashing through each dividing wall until it found Kalkan, she said. She'd come back along that route to find Drusha. The holes were easily big enough for her to get through.
Killed everything in its path, she said. Hundreds of roosting birds.
But it didn't eat anything, he observed, struggling to overcome his nausea. It slashed or bit its way through, but there's no sign of feeding.
That's important, why? She asked.
He shrugged. He took shots of the splintered holes with his picture, and then got her to hold the light steady while he measured the dimensions of each hole with his las surveyor.
Have you told anyone? He asked her.
Told anyone what?
The truth about me?
About what I am?
She shook her head.
I didn't see any point.
The Baron knows, he told her.
Right. There was movement outside, and he followed her out of the stoop. Sko was coming down the walkway through the rain. He'd changed into a foul weather suit and was hefting what looked like an auto laser, though Drusha was no expert on weapons. It had a big, chrome drum barrel and was so heavy it was supported by a gyro harness strapped around his torso. An Orspex target lens covered his right eye like a patch.
You've seen the body? She asked him.
Yes, my men are sweeping the wood behind the fence.
It came right through here, she said,
indicating the run of coops. Sko nodded and looked at Drusha, as if expecting some expert insight from him. When none came, Sko left them without a word and continued on down the path.
Who is he? Drusha asked.
Fernal Sko? He's a freelance hunter. Game specialist. The community hired him and his men when it became clear I wasn't up to the job.
There was rich contempt in her voice.
The bishop doesn't think much of him.
Drusha said. Max grinned. The bishop doesn't think much of anyone. Sko hasn't had much success so far, despite his flashy rep. Besides, the bishop has his own man on the job.
His own man?
Gundax. You'll meet him before long. He's the bishop's bodyguard. Tough piece of work.
Doesn't the bishop think Sko can get the job done?
I don't think anybody does anymore. The baron's threatened to withhold Sko's fee. Anyway, Sko's not the bishop's sort.
What?
Sko's ungodly, according to his holiness. His background is in blood sports. The imperial pits on Thustathrax.
Drusha's repose was fractured by lurid dreams of bodies that left steaming parts behind when they rolled over. In the small hours, he gave up on rest and got out of bed. He'd been given a room on an upper floor of the keep. It was terribly cold, and the wind and rain rattled the poorly fitted shutters. Drusha got dressed, activated a glow globe, and stoked some life into the portable heater. He spread out his equipment and notebooks on the table by the light of the globe and distracted himself with study. There wasn't a land predator in Gershom that even approximately fit the evidence. Prairie wolves from the western continent, Lupus cygnidae gershomi, were rapacious enough, but their pack mentality meant they were unlikely to be lone killers. The great mottled felid of the peninsula Tager, sadly almost extinct, had the bulk and power, and could have cleared the fence, but neither it nor a prairie wolf could have cut wire like that, and either would have fed. Besides, Max had given him her scribbled findings. There was no foreign matter in the poor yeoman's wounds, but she'd made an estimation of the bite radius. 53 centimetres. 53. No wolf came close. The biggest radius Drusha had measured for a felid was 37, and that had been from a skull in the Peninsula Museum. All the biggest cats were long dead now. The only thing that came close was Natha Corda Maximus, the vast, deep-ocean fish. But this was Outer Udar. There were no wolves here, no forest cats, and certainly no sharks on the loose. He looked at the picts he'd made of the holes in the coop walls. It was hard to define from the splinter damage, but it looked like each gap had been ripped open by a double blow, each point descending diagonally from the upper corners, like a man slicing an X with two swords. And what was all this talk about it having no eyes? Liam Gundax's eyes were dark and set close together. He was a tall, massively muscled man with a forked beard and braided black hair. Drusha could smell his body sweat, a scent like that of an animal.
"Who are you, and what do you want?"
It was early in the day. The rains had slowed to a drizzle, and the land was dark under a grey sky. Outer Udar was a wide skirt of rocky uplands and black forests around the dismal horizon. Drusha had come to the cathedral only to find his way into the nave, blocked by the big, fur-clad Gundax. The bishop's man was decorated with bead necklaces and wrist straps, heavy with polished stones, charms, imperial symbols, and animal teeth.
"Gundax, come away!" the bishop called out, as if calling off a dog.
He wobbled into view as Gundax stepped back.
"Drusha, my dear child," the bishop greeted him. "Pay no attention to my rogue here. This is the Magos Biologus I told you about," he told Gundax.
Gundax nodded curtly, his leather smock creaking. His charm beads clattered against each other.
"Walk with me," the bishop told Drusha.
They plodded side by side down the nave. Drusha made a few admiring remarks about the temple's towering architecture and glorious stained glasswork.
"This is a hard parish," said the bishop, "hard and hardy on the edge of beyond. Of course, I'm not complaining. I serve the God Emperor in whatever capacity he calls on me to perform, and here is as good as anywhere."
"The Emperor protects," Drusha said.
"He doesn't seem to be doing that so much here these days," said the bishop. "It weakens the faith. I have a tough enough time instilling virtue and belief into the weather-beaten folk of this blasted land, and this beast, it saps every ounce of fibre."
"It must be difficult, Your Holiness."
"Life is difficult. We rise to our tests. But, my dear Magos, I fear for the spiritual life of this community almost as much as I fear for its flesh and blood. This thing, this beast, it is not an animal. It is a test of faith, an emissary of chaos. For it to roam here, unchecked, also shows that disbelief may roam here likewise. In every sermon I preach, I declaim as much. The beast is a sign that we have fallen away and allowed taint into our souls. To kill it, to cast it out, we must first reaffirm our faith in the golden throne.
You make it sound simple, Your Holiness.
It is not, of course. But this beast may be a blessing in disguise. Ultimately, I mean, if it makes us renew our belief and our trust in the absolute sanctity of the Aquila, then I will offer thanks for it in time. Only in true adversity may a congregation find its focus.
I commend your zeal, Bishop.
So, do you have any leads? Any expert insight?
Not yet, Your Holiness.
Ah, well, early days. Come, let me bless you and your work.
Your Holiness, one thing?
Yes, Magos,
said the bishop brightly, halting in his tracks. You said the beast has no eyes. In fact, that seems to be the popular conviction. Drusha paused, remembering the words of the child in the coach.
No eyes, indeed. No eyes. That's what they say.
Who, Your Holiness? The bishop paused.
Why, the folk of Outer Udar. It is what they know of it.
I was of the understanding that no one had actually seen this thing. Seen it and survived, I mean. The bishop shrugged.
Really?
I know of no eyewitness. No one can offer any sort of description. No one knows the form or size of this thing. Of course, we can make guesses. We know it has teeth from the wounds it delivers, and from that I can estimate the size of the mouth. We know it is small enough to pass through a man-sized hole, and, I fancy, it has shearing claws or talons of some considerable size. But other than that, there is no certainty of its form or nature, and yet everyone seems certain it has no eyes. Why is that, do you think?
Tattle, smiled the bishop. Tavern talk. Fireside yap. You know how people invent things, especially if they know nothing and they're afraid. I'm sure it has eyes.
I see, said Drusha.
Now, come and receive my blessing.
Drusha endured the short blessing ritual. He didn't feel any better for it.
I would appreciate your collaboration, Magos, said Fernal Sko.
Drusha raised his eyebrows and hesitated, then let the hunter into his chambers. It was late afternoon, and an ice wind was rising in the north. Sko, dressed in a leather body glove reinforced with mail links and segments of plasteel armour plate, entered Drusha's quarters in the keep and looked around. Drusha closed the door after him. A drink? He offered.
Thank you, yes.
Drusha poured two glasses of Amasek from the flask in his luggage. Sko was wandering the room. He paused at the table and looked down at Drusha's spread-out mass of notebooks, data slates, and jottings. Sko carefully leafed through one of the sketchbooks, studying each watercolour illustration. Drusha brought him his drink.
This is fine work,
said Sko, making an admiring gesture towards the sketches.
Truly, you have a good hand and a great eye. That grazer there, just so.
Thank you.
You're no hunter, though, are you? Drusha.
The question took Drusha aback. No, he admitted.
That's fine, said Sko, sipping his drink. I didn't think so. You're just one more fool caught up in this mess.
I hear you work the Imperial Pits. Sko looked at Drusha cautiously.
Who's been talking?
Deputy Max. Sko nodded.
Well, it's true. 25 years I worked for the arena on Thustathrax as a procurer.
What's that?
I was paid to travel the wilder worlds of the Imperium, trapping and collecting animal specimens to fight in the arena. The odder, the more savage, the better. It brought the crowds in if we had something unusual.
Something like this beast? Sko didn't reply. It must have been interesting work. Dangerous work. That's why the bishop doesn't like you, isn't it? Sko managed a small smile.
The arenas of the Imperial Pits are ungodly, according to His Holiness. I was employed by a secular entertainment industry that reveled in bloodletting and carnage. I am, to him, the lowest of the low. and an outsider to boot.
What did you want, Sko?
Drusha asked. The Baron tells me my fee will be forfeit if I fail to make a kill soon. I have wages to pay, overheads to consider. This job has dragged on. I can kill this beast, Drusha, but I can't find it. I think you can. Help me, and I'll pay you a dividend of my earnings.
I'm not interested in money, said Drusha, sipping his Amasek.
You're not?
I'm interested in two things. An end to this slaughter and a personal closure. I was hired to produce a complete taxonomy of this planet's fauna. Now, at the 11th hour, I seem to have a new apex predator on my hands. If that's so, it will throw my entire work into disarray. 7 years' work, you understand?
You think this is an apex predator that you've missed?
No, said Drusha. Not even slightly. There'd be records, previous incidents. This is either a known predator gone rogue and acting abnormally, or...
Or?
It's an exotic. Sko nodded.
You've been here a day, and you're that certain?
Yes, sir.
Do you have supporting evidence?
It doesn't match anything I've turned up in 7 years. And it doesn't feed. There is no sign of appetite or predation. It simply kills and kills and kills again. That's the behaviour of a rogue animal, a carnivore that's no longer killing due to hunger. And it's the behaviour of a creature alien to this world. May I ask you a couple of questions? Sko set his empty glass down on the table.
By all means.
Why did they say it has no eyes? Where did that rumour come from?
All I know about that is that the lack of eyes is a regular feature of the bishop's hellfire sermons. I presumed it was hyperbolic invention on his part, which has fallen into common rumour.
My other question is this. You know what it is, don't you? Sko looked at him. His eyes pierced right through Drusha.
No,
he said.
By dawn the next day, there had been another death. A swineherder out beyond the crossroads had been killed in the night, and 20 of his saddlebacks along with him. Drusha went out into the sparse woodland with Sko, Max, Lussin, and 2 of Sko's huntsmen. The air was cold and ice fog wrapped the hillside. It was 10 below. At the swine farm, the bodies of hogs and hog herd alike had frozen into the mud of the pens, their copious blood making ruby-like crystals. In the steep thorn scrub above the swine farm, Drusha stopped the group and handed out the cartridges he'd prepared the night before.
"Load them into your shotguns," he said. "They won't have much range, I'm afraid."
Max and Lucin had Arbites issue riot guns. Sko had made sure his men had brought short-action pump shots along with their heavy ordnance. Both huntsmen, like Sko, were weighed down with torso rigs supporting massive auto-lasers.
"What are these?" Lussin asked.
Drusha broke a cartridge open to show them. Little chrome pellets were packed inside in a sticky fluid suspension.
"Trackers," he said. "Miniature tracker units. They have a 2,000-kilometre range. I usually use them for ringing birds. In fact, I plotted the migration patterns of the lesser beak spot and the frigate gull Tachybaptus maritimus over a 3-year period using just these very..."
"I'm sure you did a great job," snapped Max. "But can we get on?" Drusha nodded.
"I've packed them in contact adhesive. If you see anything, anything, then you mark it."
They made their way up the thorny scarp and entered a stretch of black birch woodland. Thanks to the fog, the world had become a shrunken, myopic place. Unaided visibility was 20 metres. Stark and twisted black trees hemmed them in, gradually receding into the white vapour. The earth was hard, and ground cover leaves were brittle with frost. The obscured sun backlit the fog, turning the sky into a glowing white haze. Sko spread the group into a wide line, but still close enough for every person to be visible, at least to his immediate neighbour. Drusha stayed with Max. There was an uncanny stillness, broken only by the sounds of their breathing and movement. Drusha was bone cold. Max, wearing a quilted Arbites jacket, had lent him her fox fur jacket, which he wore over his own weathercoat. His breath clouded the air.
"Do you have a weapon?" she asked.
He shook his head.
She slid a short pattern auto pistol out of an underarm rig, checked the load, and handed it to him, grip first. He looked at it, uncertainly, as if it were some new specimen for collation. It had a brushed matte finish and a black rubberized grip. "The safety's here, beside the trigger guard. If you have to fire it, hold it with both hands, and aim low because the kick lifts it."
"I don't think so," he said. "I've never been a great one for guns."
"I'd feel better if you had something."
"You wouldn't feel better if I shot you by accident, which is likely if you let me loose with something like that."
She shrugged and put it away again. "Your funeral," she said.
"I do hope not."
They walked on, another kilometre or two. Sko and his hired hands had Auspex units taped to their forearms, scanning for movement.
"What was the time of death, do you reckon?"
Drusha asked. Max pursed her lips.
4?
4:30? The bodies had a residual core temperature.
So 3 or 4 hours ago?
The chance of anything still being around seemed very slim to Drusha. Given the beast's hit-and-run habits, it would be long gone by now. But the cold offered possibilities. It had set the soil hard and solid. Tracks might remain. Drusha kept his eyes on the ground. They went across open fields, thick with rime, and along the basin of a wooded dell where the fallen leaves had frozen into a slippery mat. The fog was actually beginning to disperse, but down in the hollow it was as thick as smoke. Butcher birds, jet black and armed with shiny hook beaks, cawed, clacked, and circled in the treetops. Drusha suddenly heard an extraordinary noise. It sounded like an industrial riveter or a steam-powered loom. A puffing, pneumatic sputter interlaced with high-pitched squeals. Max started to run. Her Voxlink crackled into life.
"What is it?" Drusha called, hurrying after her.
He heard the noise again and made more sense of it. One of Sko's men had opened fire with his auto-laser. He scrambled through the frosty ground brush, trying to keep up with Max's jogging as she slipped in and out of sight between the tree trunks. Twice he went over on the frozen rug of leaves, scraping his palms.
"Max, what's going on?"
More shooting. A second weapon joining the first. Staccato puff, zwip, puff, zwip. Then the dreadful, plangent boom of a shotgun. Drusha almost ran into Max. She had stopped in her tracks. Ahead of them, in a narrow clearing between leafless tyndall trees, Sko lay on his back. It looked like his chest and groin was on fire, but Drusha realized it wasn't smoke. It was steam, wafting up from wretched wounds that had all but eviscerated him. His heavy weapon and part of its gimbal rig had been torn off and were lying on the other side of the clearing. Huge clouts of fused earth had been torn out of the ground, and 2 small trees severed completely from the fury of his shooting.
"Throne of Terror,"
Max stammered. Drusha felt oddly dislocated, as if it wasn't actually happening. They walked together, slowly, towards the body of the hunter. He still had his pump shot clamped in his hand. The end of the barrel was missing. Max suddenly swung left, her riot gun aimed. One of Sko's men stood on the other side of the clearing, half hidden by a tree, and only now visible to them. He wasn't actually standing. His body was lodged upright by the tree itself. His head was bowed onto his chest, the angle of the tilt far, far greater than any spine should allow. Max approached him tentatively and reached out a hand. When she touched him, he sagged sideways and his head flopped further. Drusha saw that only the merest shred of skin kept it attached to the rest of the body. Drusha was overcome with heaving retches, and he wobbled over to the thickets to throw up. Lucin and the other huntsman stumbled into the clearing while he was emptying his stomach.
"Did you see anything?" Max barked at the other men.
"I just heard the shooting,"
Lucin moaned. He couldn't take his eyes from Sko's awfully exposed entrails.
"That's it then,"
said the hunter. He leaned back against a tree trunk and clenched his head in his hands.
"Damn, that's it then."
"It's got to be close. Come on," Max snapped.
"And do what?"
the hunter asked.
"2 of them, with auto lasers, and they didn't kill it."
He nodded to Sko's body.
"That's my paycheck gone. All my dividends."
"Is that all you care about?"
Lucin asked.
"No," said the hunter. I care about living, too.
He took out a low stick, lit it, and sucked hard.
I told Sko we'd wasted our time here. Stayed too long. He wouldn't admit it. He said he couldn't afford to cut our losses and leave. Screw it. Screw him.
The hunter straightened up and dragged on his low stick again.
Good luck,
he said, and began to walk away.
Where the hell are you going?
Max demanded.
Where we should have gone weeks ago. As far away as possible.
Come back,
cried Lussin. The hunter shook his head and wandered away into the fog. Drusha never saw him again.
What do we do?
Lussin asked Max. She was prowling up and down, fists clenched. She growled something.
One of them got a round off with a shotgun, Drusha said.
His voice was hoarse from vomiting, and his mouth tasted foul.
You sure?
Max snapped.
I heard a shotgun, Drusha said.
I didn't, said Max.
I think I did. Maybe.
Lussin murmured softly, rubbing his eyes.
Get an arspex,
Max ordered. Drusha wasn't sure who she was speaking to, but Lussin didn't move. Reluctantly, Drusha approached Sko's body, trying not to look directly at it. He crouched down and started to peel away the tape that secured the compact scanner to Sko's left gauntlet. Sko opened his eyes and exhaled steam. Drusha screamed, and would have leapt back if the hunter's left hand hadn't grabbed his wrist.
Drusha.
Oh no! Oh no!
The hand pulled him closer. He could smell the hot, metallic stink of blood.
Saw it.
What?
I saw it.
Thin, watery blood leaked from Sko's mouth, and his breathing was ragged. His eyes were dull and filmy.
What did you see?
Asked Drusha.
You were right, Drusha. I did know what it was. Suspected. Didn't want to say. Cause a panic. And anyway, couldn't be true. Not here. Couldn't be here.
What did you see?
Drusha repeated.
All the things I've tracked and caught in my life for the pits. You know I worked for the pits?
Yes.
Never seen one before, but been told about them. You don't mess with them. Don't care what the pits would pay for one.
What was it, Sko?
The great devourer.
Sko?
The hunter tried to turn his head to look at Drusha. A torrent of black blood gushed from his mouth and nostrils, and his eyes went blank. Drusha tore the auspex from the dead man's forearm and got to his feet.
What did he say?
Max asked.
He was raving, said Drusha. The pain had taken his senses away.
He swept the auspex around and tried to adjust its depth of field. He was getting a lot of nearby bounce from the trackers that had gone wide, and pelted the ferns and tree boles. Two contacts showed at a greater range. Two of the glue-dipped teleplugs anchored to the hide of something moving northwest, just a kilometer and a half away.
Got anything?
Yes. Come on.
Max was clearly considering taking one of the heavy auto-las weapons from the corpses, but that would mean touching them.
Right, she said. Lead iron.
Max.
Yes?
Maybe I should borrow that handgun after all, Drusha said.
They hurried through the frozen woodland, following the steady returns of the auspex. The fog was burning off, and the heavy red sun was glowering down, casting a rosy tint across the iced wilderness. When they paused for a moment to catch their breaths, Max looked at the Magos.
What?
She asked.
I was just thinking.
Thinking what? Sko was looking for this thing for months. State-of-the-art trackwear, qualified help, not a sign. And then, today, he got unlucky. Damn, we all got unlucky.
No,
said Drusha. If you were the beast, wouldn't today be a good day to turn and take him out?
It was his last serious try. He's coming out with a Magos biologist at his side, changing tactics, using taggers.
What are you saying, Drusha?
Drusha shrugged.
I don't know. It's convenient, I suppose. This thing is quick and sly enough to do its evil work and stay right out of harm's way. By the time a killing is discovered, it's long gone. Today we had the best chance yet of catching it. And what does it do? It changes its habits entirely and turns on us.
So? Asked Lussin.
Almost like it knew. Almost like it was concerned that a Magos biologist and an experienced tracker might have enough skill between them to pose a realistic threat.
It's just an animal. What did you call it? An apex predator?
Maybe. But it's what a man would do. A fugitive who's evaded capture this long, but hears that the search for him has stepped up. He might decide the time was right to turn and fight.
You talk like you know what this thing is, Drusha, said Max.
I don't. It doesn't fit into any taxonomy I've studied. It doesn't fit into any Imperial taxonomy either. Except maybe classified ones.
What?
Come on.
Drusha stood up and hurried on through the copse. The air mill had been derelict for 50 years. Its weatherboards had fallen away, and the sails of its wind rotor were flaking. The district had processed its flour here, before the cheaper mass-production plant had opened in Udar town half a century ago. Drusha, Max and Lussin edged through the chokes of weed-brush towards the rear of the ruin. The tracker tags had been stationary for half an hour. Max pushed the lap-frame door open with the snout of her riot gun. They slid inside. The interior space was a dingy cone of timber and beamed floors. The mill gear ran down through the tower's spine like the gears of a gigantic clock. It smelled of mildew and rotting flower dust. Drusha took out the pistol. He pointed upwards. Lussin, riot gun gripped tightly, edged up the open-framed steps to the second level. Drushin heard something. A slither. A scurry. He hung back against the wall. There was something up with the Auspex. An interference pattern that was making the screen jump, as if an outside signal was chopping the scanner's returns. Max circled wide, gun raised to aim at the roof. Lussin reached the head of the stairs and switched around, sweeping with his gun. Drusha tried to get the Auspex to clear. Lussin screamed, and his gun went off. There was a heavy splintering sound as he fell backwards down the steps, his weapon discharging a second time. He was dead. The front of his skull was peeled off, and blood squirted into the air. Max howled and fired her riot gun into the ceiling, pumping the grip and blasting the rotten floorboards in a blizzard of wood splinters with each successive shot. Every muzzle flash lit the mill room for a millisecond. Exploding wood away before it, the beast smashed through the deck and came down at them. It was a blur, just a blur, moving faster than anything had a right to. Max's riot gun boomed again. The creature moved like smoke in a draught. Drusha had a fleeting glimpse of deep purple body plates, a snapping tail of grisly bone, forearm claws like harvest scythes. Max screamed. Drusha dropped the Auspex and fired his pistol. The recoil almost broke his wrist. He yelped in pain and frustration, stung hard by the kick. Use both hands, she told him. It turned from Max, chittering, and bounded across the floor right at him. It was beautiful. Perfect. An organic engine designed for one sole task. Murder. The muscular power of the body, the counterweight tail, the scythe limbs, like a pair of swords. The inhuman hatred. It had no eyes, at least none that he could see. Hold the gun with both hands and aim low. That's what she said, because of the kick. Drusha fired. The recoil slammed up his arms. If he'd hit anything, it wasn't obvious. He fired again. The beast opened its mouth. 53 centimeters of bite radius, teeth like thorns. The blade limbs jerking back to kill him. He fired again, and again. He saw at least one round flick away, deflected by the beast's bio-armor. It was right on him. And then it was thrown sideways against the wall. It dropped, writhed, and rose again. Drusha shot it in the head.
It lunged at him. A riot gun roared and blew it back. Bleeding from the forehead, Max stepped up and fired blast after blast. She fired until the gun was empty, and then took the pistol out of Drusha's hands and emptied that into it too. Ichor covered the walls. Frothy goo dribbled out of the beast's fractured bone armor.
"What is it?"
Max asked.
"I believe," Drusha replied, "it's called a Hormagaunt."
But Max had passed out. It took the better part of an hour for the relief team of Arbites to reach them from Udar town. Drusha had made Max comfortable by then and dressed her wounds. Pistol in hand, he'd carefully examined the beast. The goad control was easy to find, implanted in the back of the eyeless head. When Max came round again, he showed her.
"You need to deal with this."
"What does it mean?" "It means this abomination was brought here deliberately. It means that someone was controlling it, directing it in a rudimentary fashion."
"Really? Like who?"
"I'd start by asking the bishop some questions, and his pet heavy Gundax. I could be wrong, of course, because it's not my field, but I think the bishop has a lot to gain from something that puts the fear of the God Emperor into his flock. It steals the faith of a congregation to have something real to rally against."
"He did this on purpose?"
"It's just a theory." "Someone did." Max was quiet for a while. He could guess what she was thinking. There would be an investigation and an inquest. The Inquisition may have to be involved. Every aspect of life in the province would be scrutinized and pulled apart. It could take months. Drusha knew it meant he wouldn't be leaving Outer Uda any time soon. As a chief witness, he'd be required to stay. Outside, it had begun to sleet again.
"You must be happy at least,"
murmured Max. "That work of yours, your great taxonomy."
"It's all done. You've finished."
"It was done before I even got here," said Drusha, dryly. He nodded at the body of the beast. He'd covered it with a piece of sacking so he didn't have to look at it anymore. "That wasn't part of my job. Just a curiosity."
"Oh, well,"
she replied with a sigh. He went to the mill door and gazed out into the sleeting wilds. Ice pricked at his face. Gershon would be keeping him in its chilly grip a while longer yet. "Could I keep this jacket a little longer?" he asked Max, indicating the fur coat she'd lent him. "It's going to be a cold winter." That was The Curiosity, written by Dan Abnett, read by Toby Longworth.